authors, writers, dreamers, all. Each day is an invitation to accept the call. I'm Brooke Warner from She Writes.
And I'm Grant Faulkner from NaNoWriMo. You're listening to Right Minded, weekly inspiration for writers. Hello, writers, scribblers, versifiers, wordslingers, and lyricists to another episode of Right Minded. I am here today with my very right-minded co-host, Brooke Warner of She Writes, and I'm super excited about today's show because we're talking with Kwame Alexander, who's one of the hottest children's book authors these days.
Yeah, I'm super excited about Kwame, too. I actually had the privilege of seeing him keynote at the Independent Book Publishers Association a couple years back, and he was fantastic, so full of energy, so couldn't be happier to be welcoming him to the pod today.
Kwame is so many things, and I admire so many things about him, but one of the things I admire most is that he writes his story his way, which is our theme today, bending genres, telling your story your way. And one distinction, one thing that makes Kwame really distinct is that he's well known for writing his novels in verse. Imagine that.
I know, cool, right? Not an easy thing to do.
Not an easy thing to do. And Brooke, we're living in this age where sometimes I think things are becoming actually more conventional. There are all these best practices out there, all these how to write your book in any kind of genre. And perhaps things are narrowing. I sometimes worry that it's people are being guided to fit their stories into a particular marketing niche, so it's harder to break the rules in many ways. What's your take on being deviant or transgressive with your stories?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the trend that you're speaking to is because of the traditional publishing industry and the ways in which the traditional industry is contracting, and it makes it harder for them to take risks. It makes it more difficult for acquisitions editors to see something unique like a novel in verse and say, ooh, I want to take a chance on that because there's no history of something like that having done well before. And I think it's why I love the indie author space so much, because authors can come in and do something different and test it without necessarily needing the approval of those gatekeepers.
Yeah. You know, sometimes I think of books that are unconventional but widely revered. And so I oftentimes think of Moby Dick. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people read that when they go to college. And of course, within Moby Dick, if you haven't read it, there are maybe it seems like hundreds of pages of kind of whale lore and history. And I think if Herman Melville were to write Moby Dick today, like editors would just slash so many parts of that out of it. And I happen to think that even if you can't quite make your way through those boring parts of Moby Dick, they add to the texture of it and just the enormity of the story. We might not have Moby Dick if it were written today. And I think we might not have a lot of books. And when I wrote Pep Talks for Writers, I have a chapter about rejection. And so many great authors have been rejected, but kind of persisted and gotten their stories through. And so, like, for instance, Beatrix Potter, she self-published Peter Rabbit. I read this morning that Proust self-published his In Remembrance of Things Past. I'm not sure if that's entirely true, but I was amazed by that.
And Charles Dickens, famously.
Yeah, a long list of people. And I have two little quotes I want to read. Richard Bach, who wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull, was told, "Nobody will want to read a book about a seagull." And yet millions of people did buy that book and read that story. And William Golding's Lord of the Flies was described in a rejection letter as an absurd and uninteresting fantasy, which is rubbish and dull. So I love hearing those stories because they motivate me to accept the unconventional ways that people tell stories and to honor them.
And I think that's great. And I just have to weigh in here to say, just because I am in this space so much and because I'm a publisher and thinking about the different ways in which people enter into the industry, there are different ways to break the rules. And so breaking the rules in the way that you present your story, how you tell it, even how you write it structurally, sometimes the way books are done, I'm such a proponent of that. I think it's fantastic to get in there and do what you're going to do and be transgressive in that way. One of the ways in which I'd recommend writers and authors not break the rules, however, is in book production and design, things like price points and trim sizes, because I think sometimes, well, I've seen this, I guess, is authors saying, well, I'm going to do something super unconventional with my trim size. I'm going to underprice this thing so that I'm going to sell the heck out of it. Things like omitting running heads because you think that makes the book look better, or fake blurbs is another thing I really don't like, where people are kind of cleverly making up blurbs, and, you know, they think it's funny. Maybe it is for a certain kind of book. So it's like you still have to play within the sandbox. You need to follow the rules of the gold standard of publishing and publish a professional book, and then save that exciting, you know, interesting energy that may or may not be transgressive for how you tell the story.
Yeah, exactly. Honor your vision for your story and see it through. I think that's the way great stories are written. On that note, what is your green light moment today?
Yeah, so this week's green light moment is inspired by Kwame because it got me thinking about another children's book author that I know. He's a local author here in Oakland, Inosanto Nagara. And Inosanto first self-published his book, A is for Activist. Maybe some of you have seen it. It's a really cool children's book about activism and social justice. So he did a first printing, which was supported by a crowdfunding campaign, and then he got picked up by Seven Stories Press. And of course, that's a success story. Many authors want to be picked up by traditional presses, and sometimes not. Sometimes people are staunchly independent and want to remain that way. But Inosanto is also transgressive in a sense, not so much in that he didn't follow the rules, but like a lot of writers who set out to write the book they want to write, he didn't so much care what the big publishers wanted. And I saw in a Publishers Weekly interview where he said, "I was writing it for my family and my friends who shared values, not just trying to reach a least common denominator audience." And what he's speaking to, this dumbing down of our content, is probably the biggest tragedy that I see in big publishing, and why I think it's exciting when people like Kwame and Inosanto do what they're going to do. And to me, these are authors of, or examples of authors rather, who, you know, they got picked up by bigger presses. Kwame now has his own imprint, but they are doing the thing that they want to do, and they are validating themselves and their visions by publishing these books that they know have a wider readership. And for me, that is the definition of a green lighter.
Brooke, I love that story about Inosanto. I love the intimacy of the audience he chose to tell his story to, his family, and focusing on just his family. I bet that gave him a kind of purity to his writing and to his story. And I think you have to trust in the vision of your story no matter what the detractors say.
Yeah, so agreed. And let's transition to your pep talk, Grant. I love that we're doing a green light moment and a pep talk every week, so lay it on us.
Well, this is something I'm probably going to repeat like every show, and maybe multiple times every show. But, you know, the NaNoWriMo credo is that everyone's story matters. And that means to write your story and to write it your way. You know, we really want people to discover their story in the kind of crazy exploratory process of writing a rough draft. And I think there's so many voices in the world telling us how we're supposed to write a story. And I think some of those are our own inner editor who, you know, maybe wants to us to write it, you know, something that sells or something that fits in certain conventions, or we just have an idea of what a story should be. But I think the stories where the author takes risks and obviously writes with a clear singular vision are the stories that really speak to us. And I want to share this quote from Virginia Woolf from her book, A Room of One's Own. She says, "Literature is strewn with the wreckage of men who have minded beyond reason the opinions of others." And of course, we have to cross out that word men and make it much more inclusive. But I think the spirit of the quote is that what she's getting at is that when we listen to those opinions of others, we can oftentimes be diminished and our story and our vision can become diminished. And I've recently experienced this personally because I've written a novel in this very sort of kooky, very uncommercial format. I've told the story of these two lovers through letters that are written but never sent. I love epistolary novels. I love letter writing in general. And I found it was a really good way to tell this story. But it's an unconventional format. It's not for everybody. And certainly, like, agents aren't clamoring to represent me right now. But I see the story this way, and I'm going to keep tweaking it, noodling with it. I really want it to work, and I don't even care if it gets published. This is my vision for the story, and it's just going to have to be that way. So I recommend to people to find that defiance within themselves. You know, I think you need a defiance to tell your story your way. And it's a balancing act, of course, because we do need to listen to others. We do need to consider other angles. And if we want to sell something, sometimes we need to fit it into a convention. So I don't want people to dishonor that necessarily, but just to find what works for you and your story, and to keep those voices. Don't let those voices take your story away from you.
Well, good for you. I think it's great. I think that you gotta get in there and do what you're gonna do, and then see if you can make it work. You make it work and toil away. It's perfect.
Hopefully there'll be something to report.
Thanks so much for that pep talk, Grant. And right after this break, we're going to hear from Kwame Alexander. Can't wait.
Well, hey, I'm super excited to introduce Kwame Alexander because I find him to be one of the most inspiring authors in the world. In fact, I'm convinced that Kwame has been cloned because I don't see how he could be visiting so many schools, speaking at so many conferences, writing so many books, and then appearing on podcasts like this one. If you're unfamiliar with Kwame, he is a poet, educator, and the New York Times best-selling author of 25 books, including Rebound, the follow-up to his Newbery Medal-winning middle-grade novel, The Crossover. And Kwame writes for children of all ages as well. Some of his other works include The Playbook, 52 Rules to Help You Aim, Shoot, and Score in This Game of Life, and then picture books like Surf's Up, Animal Ark, and Out of Wonder, and the novels Solo and Booked. So he's also been honored with a slew of awards, and he's the founding editor of Versify, a new imprint of Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Books for young readers. And then we're going to learn a little bit more about Versify today. Welcome, Kwame.
Wow, man. Thank you. That was a lot. I feel exhausted just listening to it.
Well, we're talking to just one of your clones, right?
Exactly. It can't possibly be me.
Yeah, yeah. You're like Santa Claus at Christmas. You're just ever present around the world.
Dude, people ask me all the time, how do you do all of this? How do you write all these books? How do you do all this stuff? And my answer is, I have no idea. And I don't stop to figure it out. I think if I did, I'd probably go crazy.
I bet you would. Well, I'm going to stick with my clone theory for the time being here because it would make me feel too bad about how much I get done in my life if I didn't have that theory. But I'm excited to talk with you because I love authors who take risks and do things that might be considered counterintuitive or even uncommercial. And I mention this because when I think of writing stories for kids, I think that the very last approach I might take is writing the story in verse. Yet your books have reached so many readers because they're in verse, not in spite of it. And so I wanted to hear your thoughts on why do you think so many young readers have responded to your genre-bending style?
Well, I think when you think about verse and rhyme and rhythm and poetry, and you think about kids, of course they go together. I mean, what kid didn't learn Dr. Seuss? What kid wasn't familiar with Green Eggs and Ham? You know, what kid didn't get lullabies sang to them by their parents? Or, you know, what kid didn't have some connection to Shel Silverstein or really funny rhyming verse? Like, that's how we learn. We learn how to speak, write, listen, and you know, by rhythm and rhyme. And so it makes perfect sense to me. Like, but apparently to everybody in the industry, nobody got it. And I do. I just think that is the way that kids communicate, learn, and love literature. It's through the rhythm. It's through the figurative language. It's through the really sparse text. And ultimately, it's through, you know, having some sort of emotional connection, all the things that poetry is. So when I said about writing novels in verse, I knew this was going to be the thing. It just made perfect sense to me. And I guess I've spent the last 4 years trying to convince everybody else that it is the case.
I love the confidence you had in your vision of telling the story. I think that's valuable for every writer, no matter if they're writing in verse or not. And I know I remember talking with you once and using the term reluctant reader. And you said that you didn't believe in the term. It's a phrase that's often used in educational circles in particular. And so I'd love if you could tell me your take on the kids that many label as reluctant readers.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like the word. I think it's a personal thing for me because I was called reluctant and I was the most well-read kid in my high school. Like, my parents, they worked in the education field. They attended teachers college. My father was a publisher. My parents were writers. I had this like intimate connection with books, so much so that I had read 100 books in first grade during the summer. You know, by seventh grade, I had read books like Pedagogy of the Oppressed by Paulo Freire, which most graduate students were reading. I had read most of the Heinemann African Writer series. I had read so many books, and most of those books I was forced to read by my dad because, you know, he thought that was the thing, you know, to do to get me to read these books that he was interested in, but I wasn't. So I didn't have a choice what I had to read. So the deal isn't I wasn't reluctant to read. I was reluctant to read the books he was giving me. And so I find that that shouldn't be sort of the go-to place for us as educators, as parents, as teachers, that kids who aren't reading are reluctant. How about they're just not interested in what we're giving them? How about we give them a book that they're going to, you know, get excited about? How about we find the book that's going to connect with them? And for me, you know, that was sports. It was Muhammad Ali. I was reading a book about Ali last night. And that was, you know, that's the thing that got me as a 12-year-old, is this book called The Greatest. So I think we got to find books that kids are interested in, because they're not necessarily reluctant. They're just not interested.
Yeah, it's such a good point. I have a 7-year-old boy, and so I know that parents everywhere relate and respond to exactly what you're saying. And Kwame, you're such an amazing ambassador for helping everyone tell their story through your work with the organization you founded, Book in a Day, and now as an ambassador for The Great American Read. Do you think this known problem of lack of diversity in children's literature is improving at all?
Is the lack of diversity in...
in children's literature, yeah. Is it getting better?
Sure, I hear the question. I guess I was going to ask you, is it improving in our lives?
Right.
You know, I mean, think about it. Like, who are you hanging out with? Who are you having dinner with? Who are your kids going to school with? Like, the diversity in kids lit is representative of the diversity in America, in the sense of, yeah, there's a lot of different kinds of people from different backgrounds, just like there's a lot of potential books from different, about different people from different backgrounds. But are we really sort of living the kind of life, you know, that that is representative of what we're saying we want in the books? And so it's one thing to talk about, we need to have more books, but how about the books we have? We need to have more books that are diverse on our shelves. Like, what kind of books are on your bookshelf? So I just get real, it's a real interesting topic, and it's not like one answer. And of course there should be more diversity in books, because there's more, you know, there's more stories to tell. There's more people in our lives. But I think more importantly, I just want us to have more diverse lives.
Right. I mean, I hear you. It sounds like you're saying it's not enough, right? I mean, we can have diversity in children's literature. We can talk about it, but there's some kind of lack of follow through or conversation about how is it impacting people.
I think you answered the question, Brooke. I'm going to write that down. I'm going to steal that.
Please do.
I'm taking it.
Well, hey, Kwame, you know, your life as a writer has been a long and winding one, as I think most writers' lives are. And I recently read or heard the story about the crossover. And I read that 22 publishers rejected it. And most said there was no market for a poetry-infused, sports-themed children's book because boys wouldn't read poetry and girls wouldn't read about sports.
Right.
So I'm very intrigued by writers who receive and overcome a volume of rejections like that. Like, how did you have the patience to keep going and to dig in and keep going after so many rejections? Like, I oftentimes say that for me, at least, rejection is a revision tool. It helps me go deeper into the work. Was that the case with you?
Yeah, it was that, but it also is, it pissed me off. I mean, it was frustrating. You know, it was sad. It was tragic to get just that much rejection, but I'm not like the only writer. Like, most of us go through this. I think it's a part of the journey. I think what allowed me to keep going forward was because ultimately I believed in the project. You know, I was passionate about it. I had put in the work. I knew what I was talking about. And generally I loved the story. And I think when you have that kind of relationship to your art, it doesn't matter if someone is saying, you know, your art can't be exhibited in this gallery, then you'll go sell it on the street. It doesn't matter if someone is saying, you know, your book is not that good for whatever reason, and so we aren't going to publish it, you'll go publish it yourself. So ultimately, that's what it came down to. I believed in it enough where I just decided, you know, if these people don't think it's that good, yeah, it makes me frustrated and maybe I'm doubting myself, but ultimately, I feel like it's good, so I'm just going to publish it myself. And I think once I had that, you know, that intention, and I made that decision, I felt like ultimately a little bit more in control. And that's when the offer started coming in. It was really interesting. Once I decided to publish it myself, then I got some interest in the book. And that was, you know, a 5-year journey.
I hope that works for every writer, that once they decide to self-publish their book, the door opens to more.
Right.
Did you ever have a moment where you just woke up and said, that's it, I should give up?
Probably about 36 of them. Yeah, it happened. You know, I started writing. I wrote my first book in 94. And there were moments during that first book, you know, 5-10 times where I was like, I can't do this. It's too much. I just can't. I can't publish this book. I don't have the money. I can't deal with all the work. It's just too much work, the stress. So, you know, and I remember my dad gave me seven, like I was at my wit's end. Like I had finally gotten up enough nerve and confidence to publish the book in 94 and of course didn't have the money. And my dad had given me $1,700 to go and print the books. So that particular relationship to the work, doubting that this is really something I want to do or can do. It happened a lot. I have my 28th book coming out October the 2nd. And this is, you know, this is not hyperbole. This is completely accurate. Yesterday I had this thought, this book isn't supposed to happen. Maybe, you know, so this is yesterday. And so, and for a variety of reasons, I just came to this conclusion, maybe this book is just not going to happen. And maybe I just don't want it to happen. So I think as writers, you know, for myself, yeah, I still deal with that. But I think that's cool. It's all a part of the journey, the writerly journey. Ultimately, what the thing is, how much do you love what you're doing? And will you work through all that stuff? Because I think that stuff is, it just makes you stronger. It makes you have more, you know, clearer vision about the path we're on. But I think that stuff is a part of it. You just got to deal with it and accept it and learn from it and figure it out and sort of figure out how to make the, you know, the magic happen out of whatever type of challenges or doubts you're having.
Well, Kwame, I love your passion and sounds like you also have a good dad. Could you tell us in closing about Versify, your new imprint?
Yes. Yeah, so we have an imprint at Houghton Mifflin, and it's primarily a children's book imprint. So we'll be publishing authors, picture book authors, middle grade, young adult, graphic novelist, nonfiction. We'll be publishing 4 to 7 books a year. The first list comes out in the spring of 2019. We'll launch with 6 books next year, 4 novels and 2 picture books. One is sort of a Phantom Tollbooth-esque novel about 2 boys who are about to go back to school and they find a camera that freezes time and about their sort of fantasy adventure. It's called The Last Day of Summer, and it's by Lamar Giles. We have a novel about German teenagers in Nazi Germany who are a part of the resistance, which I think is really apropos to these days about how do you, you know, find your voice? How do you raise your voice about things that matter? What can young people do to sort of find their place in this world and help make it a better place? And then we got some great picture books. So the goal is to, you know, I tell people all the time, for so long, publishing has been this great dinner party. And every now and then there'll be some special guests invited. But there's generally certain people who have been at the table enjoying themselves. And I wanted to create a publishing company. I wanted to create a dinner party where, you know, every seat at the table is filled and everybody has an opportunity to partake. And we all share and we enjoy and we enlighten and ultimately we empower each other through the words on the page. So that's the goal with Versify.
Thanks so much, Kwame. I love that metaphor of the dinner party and opening it up so that more people can come and taste the special dishes. That's beautiful. You said it much better than that, of course, but because you're a poet.
Right, right.
But thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kwame.
Thank you all so much for having me.
All right, so let's move into our writing action. What do you have for us, Grant?
Yeah, I love hearing Kwame talk, and I love that he took this fantastic risk with writing a novel in verse, something that I think it would be really tough for me to venture in that direction. So I think it's an important reminder that we can learn by doing something unconventional with our writing. And so this week's writing action is to do something unconventional. And I'm going to give a challenge based on Kwame's novel, is to write a story in verse. Doesn't have to be a long story, can just be a little anecdote, but put it in verse and see how it allows you to access your story in a different way. And then going beyond that, after you do this, think of other unconventional techniques you can bring to your writing and your story. I bet they'll make it better.
Thanks for being with us this week, everybody. Remember that Right Minded is a weekly podcast. You can download it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll see you next week.